It's Friday, March the 12th, and this is the Inside Politics podcast wrap of the week from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Lenehan. With me today are Jack Horgan-Jones and Pat Leahy. Hello to you both.
Hello, Hugh.
Bonjour.
Jack, if there's a story of the week on what is, I think, was a relatively quiet week, it's ongoing debates about the cost of living and price of stuff and whether the political system can do anything about it at all.
Yes, the price of stuff debate rages on. You're right, it was a little bit kind of all over the place, the news agenda this week. No big news story kind of took over, certainly from the point of view of politics. To the extent that one did, it was the ongoing debate over the cost of living, or more specifically, the extent to which the government wants to or can influence the climb down in prices that people are now expecting to see, given the fact that the worst or the most kind of aggressive phase of inflation seems to be at least abating, if not actually reversing yet. In the spotlight this week was the junior minister for retail, Neil Richmond, Fine Gael TD for Dublin Rathdown, who convened a retail forum, the grandiosely titled Retail Forum, on Wednesday. Now, this is a political trick as old as the hills, roughly equivalent to a kind of perp walk where you bring in the people who are seen to be responsible, or at least semi-responsible, for the bad thing, and you give them a bit of a bollocking and you hopefully generate some good news headlines for yourself. The problem was, I think, that it kind of suffered from being the only centre of gravity, really, to the news agenda politically for the week, because the retail forum is not the world's most powerful or important setting.
I think that's putting it mildly.
Yeah, it's putting it somewhat diplomatically. It's basically a talking shop. And when it comes to actually the big stick that the government may carry when it comes to coercing retailers to putting down prices, they don't carry much of a big stick at all. The one power that they do really have, which was referred to early and often in the week, is powers under the 2007 legislation to set a price ceiling on certain staple goods. Now, that only occurs in the context of an emergency, so kind of like a war or something like COVID, you know. And while they talked about it early enough, and they started towards the middle of the week when the retail forum kind of came into view, they started talking about it less. They started talking less about the big stick that they carried and more about the fact that, you know, maybe the stick isn't that big after all, or we don't really want to use the stick at all.
Or they don't have a stick.
Or they don't have a stick, yeah. So they kind of, by the time the retail forum came around, you know, it was more an advertisement for the government's lack of immediate powers, and certainly what the opposition suggested was the government's lack of interest in giving itself more powers or giving the regulators more powers to actually tackle high retail prices or high grocery prices. And I think that because that dynamic emerged, it ended up fitting more into a series of stories where I suppose the coalition or politics more generally kind of advertises its own inadequacies. So like when it comes to something like, you know, mortgage interest rates, obviously that's something that is set by the ECB. And while we can kind of crib and moan about it a little bit here, the government hasn't shown much interest, probably for good reason, in mortgage interest schemes that might give households a break from that. Similarly, energy bills, you know, which is something that they've certainly shifted gear on rhetorically, and ministers are talking tough, but in terms of actually forcing them down, you know, they are more or less regurgitating the viewpoint of utility companies who say they're still working through their hedging arrangements and there's a lag between wholesale prices that they pay and retail prices coming down. So I think that, look, it's in the same space as governments often find themselves when it comes to tackling a chronic policy problem, which is you end up merely describing it or, you know, talking about the shape and size of it as opposed to being seen to do anything about it. And that's, I think, a politically dangerous place to be for as long as the issue persists. The hope is that, like, you know, the natural swing of inflation means that we have topped out and, you know, it may actually see prices come down a little bit towards the back end of this year. But I think that the more fundamental problem is that those prices are probably locked in. Liv Riker last night, the Taoiseach on Virgin Media, talking about how after a period of rapid inflation, things don't go back to the way they were before. So now this is the water that you swim and things are just more expensive. And that brings into view the more kind of complex question of what do you do come budget time? Because what the government has been effective at doing is backstopping and providing, you know, a financial, you know, auxiliary reserve tank to households as opposed to fixing the market. So it begs the question of what they're going to do, what the pressures will be on them come budget time, and, you know, how that kind of matches up against all the kind of fiscal prudence stuff. You know, what do we do of the surplus stuff that we talked about in recent days.
Yeah, I mean, Pat, I would distinguish between the energy issue, which arose immediately after in the course of the Ukraine war in particular, and which one would hope those prices will come down at some point as we see commodity energy prices around the world are going down at the moment, and that filters through. And maybe you can try and encourage our local energy companies to let it filter through a bit more. But as Jack says, you know, prices in the supermarkets, you know, inflation may be easing, but the prices aren't going to come down. Is it beyond the wit of the political system to take us as adults and just tell us the truth about that?
Yes. I mean, it seems to me that it was Teddy Roosevelt who said that the US should talk softly and carry a big stick. Well, the government seems to talk loudly and carry a tiny stick, so to speak, on this. And, you know, there are mechanisms if the government wishes to control prices, as Jack alluded to, but they are, you know, to be used only in the most extreme circumstances. And were the government to attempt to use them, you know, in the current circumstances, it would almost certainly find itself the subject of legal challenges, which makes it, you know, all the more curious that, you know, that government insists on, you know, holding this forum, talking up its chances, and then sending the supermarkets away with a flea in their ear, and then everybody just kind of looks the other way while nothing happens. Interestingly, you know, this recognition seems to extend across the political divide. I heard, and I'm going to be writing a little bit about this tomorrow, but I heard Louise O'Reilly, who is the Sinn Féin Enterprise spokesman. I know Wilting Violet, but she was being asked on RTE the other day, you know, what would you do? What would you do? And the best she could come up with was, well, you know, we would set targets. And, you know, she didn't, you know, resile at all from lambasting the government for its performance. But when asked what she would do, I guess she was, you know, wary of giving any hostages to fortune and just kept repeating that they would set targets without actually being drawn on what those targets would be or what the enforcement mechanisms might be to ensure that they were achieved. You know, look, everybody is slightly riled by higher prices. What can the government do about it? Very little. It can throw some money at us in the budget, and I think that's what it'll do.
So, Jack, I mean, the real problem for the government here, as you say, comes later in the year when people start asking for measures in the budget of one sort or another to deal with this kind of crisis. And that can manifest itself in all kinds of ways. Our lead story in the Irish Times this morning is about very vociferous complaints from nursing homes who have residents funded by the Fair Deal scheme, which is a way in which the state subvents private nursing homes. But they point out that they get a lot less money than publicly funded nursing homes, and that it's gone completely out of whack over the last few years. And I think there's a nursing home which is now closing down. Those are the kinds of pressures that are going to happen across the economy in this kind of an environment after 2 or 3 years of relatively high inflation.
Yeah, but I think that inflation probably won't be quite as bad come budget time this year as it was last year. Remember, just at the tail end of August, or maybe into September last year, it was around the time of the Fine Gael thinking down in Kilkenny, and there was a major shock through the system because the futures prices for oil and gas just went absolutely haywire. Now, they had been haywire, but they went, you know, above and beyond. And the projections that the government were getting in on household bills over the winter, one senior source described to me at the time, were more like a mortgage payment. And it didn't quite come to pass, but something quite like it came to pass. But what that triggered was, and what it went in tandem with was yet another bonanza corporation tax take. And what it triggered was the massive escalation, really, of supports that were outlined in the last budget, a bunch of them being one-off, but most importantly being the 600 per household in €300 credits, electricity credits, across the winter. So I think the question will be, if we don't get a similar kind of shock, to what extent will the government actually replicate that? And to what extent will this kind of ad hoc, you know, goody giveaway, once-off payment become part of the budgetary furniture, which is a more kind of long or medium term question? And how will it marry those obligations to the demands that I think would be actually louder this year for real and lasting and you know, permanent changes to things like welfare and pension rates, which obviously went up quite significantly last year. If memory serves, the weekly sum went up by 12 euros, but that was askance from the impact of inflation. It would have had to go up 20 euros to keep up with inflation. So the view of those who advocate for higher pension and welfare payments is that we're already at a bit of a dogleg. We're already running to catch up with the impact of last year, and even if inflation is less than it was last year, nonetheless, you still have to compensate for that. So I think that, you know, they'll be under pressure on both those fronts, and I think that actually the fight that they'll be most pressed on will be to keep away from those permanent increases, because I think that in the final reckoning, particularly as you know, emergency style or really acute pressures from inflation kind of fade, to the extent that, you know, people might like the prospect of people not being able to pay a bill might abate a little bit. Warding off those calls for permanent increases will be the row of this kind of late summer, early autumn. It should be said there will be increases, but it's the scale of them that they'll be warding off.
I wonder though, Pat, I mean, this whole business of one-off payments as opposed to committing to, you know, to paying things forever sort of emerged a lot during the COVID era, and the government's been quite fond of it over the last couple of years. There must be a limit to it at some point. You can't just bake it into the system forever, can you? That, you know, here's your one-off payments for next year. At some point, people will start expecting that they're always
going to come. Look at the Christmas bonus. Sorry to jump in, but like, I mean, look at the Christmas bonus. You know, I mean, that kind of...
Well, that's the point. Christmas bonus is never budgeted for. It's just given at the end of the year. Of course, there was a period when the Christmas bonus was diminished. Yeah, during the... during the late era of austerity. But... you know, I wouldn't overestimate the extent to which there's a lot of long-term thinking going in on this, Hugh. You know, I mean, as Jack says, there will be spending increases in the budget. I'd be surprised if they aren't, you know, similar in scale to last year, which, you know, let us not forget, was by historical comparisons an extremely generous budget, about 7 billion euros in recurring budget day measures. But there was an additional, what really turbocharged it was, there was an additional 4 billion euros in one-off measures. Now, you know, this is, a repeat of this, I think, would be frowned upon at EU level, because it is, after all, working against EU monetary policy or ECB monetary policy, which is, you know, to take money out of the economy in a bid to curb inflation. But, you know, when I don't think it'll be specifically prohibited by EU rules, and when faced with the choice of annoying some people in Frankfurt are annoying some people in their constituencies, I think the government is likely to choose the former.
All right. I think our next story is very different. I find it absolutely fascinating, not just because of the details of the story itself, but because I think of what it reveals about the way Ireland really works. It comes from our colleague Conor Gallagher, who has written a book about the history of Irish neutrality. And I think we've all been aware, at least I have been, that somehow or other, the Irish state with a nod and a wink, relied upon the British armed forces to, you know, patrol along the northern edge, the northwestern edge of Ireland and the Atlantic. And it was more than a nod and a wink. It was a secret memorandum, which Conor has discovered, Pat, which has been in existence since 1953. So almost 70 years, Irish governments have been signing this thing. It's kind of fascinating.
We love an old secret memorandum, you know. Indeed, dates from, I think, 1953. So when the young Queen Elizabeth was being crowned in Westminster Abbey, Irish and British civil servants were huddled in a room agreeing this secret memo or something like that. I think the reason why this is, I mean, as you say, we've always kind of suspected this for years. The reason it is of, I suppose, added political potency now is that I think Irish neutrality is kind of is in focus at home and abroad in a way that it hasn't been. And that's because the entire security and defence context in Europe has been utterly upended by the Russian invasion of Ukraine. You have, you know, Sweden and Finland, formerly neutral countries, joining NATO. You have Germany, you know, upending decades of precedent by agreeing to supply arms to Ukraine, putting in a 100 billion euro program of investment in its own armed forces. And all across Europe, as a result of the invasion of Ukraine, defense postures. And, you know, if you want to find out how, you know, immediate an issue this is for lots of people, talk to some people from Central and European countries that are much, much closer to Russia as than we are, and have a history of unwelcome intrusions from that quarter. Talk to them about how seriously they take it, and I can tell you it's a bit of an eye opener. And as a result of that, I think that Ireland's kind of nod and wink approach to international defence cooperation and our neutrality, under which we, I suppose, existed and indeed prospered under the protection of the NATO military umbrella since the 1950s, without overtly contributing anything to it. I think that's under increased focus now. And it is, of course, you know, the right of this country and any other country to have its own foreign policy. And if we so choose to have that as entirely militarily unaligned. But that's not really what we've been pursuing for the last half a century, you know. And I think that what one of the things Connor's story does, and I'm sure his forthcoming book will do, is maybe to, you know, to force us to face up to the reality of how our neutrality is actually operated, and to what a true neutrality might actually mean, which would be something very different to what we currently operate.
Well, Jack, you're not entirely militarily unaligned if you're relying on another state for a very significant portion of your defence, are you?
I suppose you're not, Hugh. I mean, this debate, as Pat has articulated at length there, has been going on since the 1950s, but has kind of ebbed and flowed depending on the overriding mood music and the geopolitical situation, and it's kind of crystallized things in the last year or so. I don't know where this ends up, really. Like, it strikes me that about a year ago, we were on this podcast talking about how the conversation about Irish neutrality would change, and, you know, it would, the current position was not sustainable. And since then, the conversation doesn't seem to have changed that much. We seem to still be having different versions of the same chat. You know, the Taoiseach has outlined this new forum for discussing Irish, I suppose, neutrality and you know, security policy.
That's the second forum of the podcast so far. Yeah, that tells us something.
It feels a little like a bit of a kick to touch, and
probably, oh, surely not.
Probably a hope underpinning this, that rather than actually having a substantive discussion about this, notwithstanding Connor's book, which I know he was too modest to talk about in his own copy, but we'll give it a sufficient plug here.
But Dean Ferreter was plugging the bejeepers out of plugging this morning.
Exactly, so, yeah. Yeah. But you know, it's interesting that you mentioned the Dean Ferreter piece, because he points out that, like, the ambivalence of Irish neutrality has a long history, and it stretches back really to the foundation of the state and shortly thereafter. So I think that, notwithstanding the fact that, you know, we're all talking about this a little bit more, and we all have very kind of gravely intoned that, you know, it's a big moment for Irish neutrality, it seems that there is certainly on some levels a desire to kind of, let's see how this one plays out and see if we might not kind of hold tight to that ambivalence that has always suited us so well. But, you know, the question is whether that is a maintainable position. Like, just reading Connie's piece from, I think it was Monday now, this stage, like I knew that the Irish Air Corps was under-equipped, but, like, I had no idea really just quite how under-equipped it was, and the fact that, like, we can take on a helicopter maybe with the height of the hardware that we possess, but very little more than that, and what passes for a combat aircraft can't really fly effectively above 10,000 feet. I mean, that's that is not great. That's my defense analysis.
If we were attacked with a fleet of World War One biplanes, we might be able to defend ourselves. But anything beyond that would be problematic.
Funny you should mention that, Pat, because the Dermot Ferriter piece is fascinating in lots of ways. And he writes about Erskine Childers, who was specifically part of the delegation to London that negotiated the treaty because of his military knowledge, because he had been a member of the British Armed Forces and specifically one of the precursors of the RAF. So he knew what he was talking about. Now, of course, not much more than a year or so after that, he ended up being executed by the new Free State government during the Civil War, which was ultimately an argument about national sovereignty and the limitations of it vis-a-vis the United Kingdom. So there's a sense almost of things coming full circle. There's lots of interesting stuff actually in the newspaper this week about those times, including that the British offered to provide bombers to bomb the forecourts with Irish colours on them, an offer which was rejected, although I think the Free State did take its artillery to shell the forecourts in the end. So all of this goes back a terribly, terribly long way. But at one point in his piece, Pat, Dermot Ferriter talks about how the Department of Foreign Affairs' position has always been, it always refers to our traditional position of neutrality, which of course has no constitutional basis or anything like that. I'm not even sure it has a legal basis. The kind of describing it as such feels a little bit like it's something like Illan pipes, or like, you know, saying thank you to the driver when you're getting off the bus or something like that, you know?
I mean, in practice, our traditional policy of military neutrality, to give it its full title, Hugh, has actually meant whatever the government of the day wants it to mean. But I don't think we should underestimate the public attachment to an albeit kind of not entirely fully formed idea of what neutrality should mean. And opinion polls are very clear about this, and we've done several of them ourselves. There is a very large majority of people who are against joining NATO, are against having an EU army, however you might define that, and are very attached to this hazy idea of military neutrality, however they define it. That having been said, right, there are two things I think that are pressing in on this at the moment. One is the changed security and defence context in Russia, or in Europe, rather, as a result of the war in Ukraine that we referred to earlier. And increasingly, if you talk to politicians and officials who are in meetings in the EU, there is a perception, you know, that Irish neutrality is not so much one of those quirks that people put up with amongst other member states, and more looks a bit more like freeloading to at least some people in the EU. The other thing I think that has changed the context on it is the fact that, you know, we now know that Russian naval exercises seem to be fairly regular off the West Coast, and there is a growing fear that the internet cables that link the US and the EU are being targeted for potential sabotage by Russia. And that is something that, the EU, I think, is going to require action on.
Notwithstanding the fact that I spent a couple of minutes there saying nothing's going to change, I do think that there is a chance that one of the kind of pillars of Irish defence policy could be unwound as a result of all this, and that's the triple lock, which is not a constitutional demand.
Just explain what the triple lock is.
Sorry, the triple lock basically means that you can't deploy more than a certain number of Irish troops. I think it's 12 overseas.
Handful, yeah.
Without three things happening: a UN Security Council resolution, a formal decision by the government, and approval by the Dáil. And the first of those things, the Security Council resolution, has been targeted initially by Fine Gael as not being kind of match fit or fit for purpose anymore, because Russia is a permanent holder of a seat on the UN Security Council, and is obviously seen, certainly in the context of Ukraine, but in a more general sense in global affairs, as a bad actor these days. Therefore, it's not a sustainable position. So goes the criticism anyway, that we would allow a bad actor or a bad faith actor or someone who has unleashed a war in Europe to effectively have a say on our deployment of troops and our defence policy. And that is a position that it seems both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have. And because it's not a constitutional requirement, because I think the legislation is quite old, but I think it's been modified as recently as the 1990s, I suspect that there could be some kind of change there which allows a more kind of full throated participation in whatever security, whatever kind of supranational security arrangements emerge from the post-Ukraine shakeup. And this is something that the Taoiseach has been kind of more vocal on, talking about how he wants to see Ireland play an increased part in whatever kind of European security structures emerge, falling some way short of joining anything like NATO, but certainly putting our best foot forward on that front. So that's something that I think could be a lasting legacy of this. If they actually have the political appetite for it, and if, I suppose, the Greens were willing to get on board with it. I'm not sure exactly their position on it.
No, we'll leave it there, but I think that is a subject we'll be returning to. Before we take a break, just to remind you that to read Dermot Ferriter's article today, or Conor Gallagher's really interesting article earlier in the week, or indeed lots of other coverage of that and many other issues, you'd need to be a subscriber to IrishTimes.com. It's very easy to do that. You just go to IrishTimes.com/subscribe and you can sign up there. We'll be back after this. And you're very welcome back. Pat, I've been observing the progress of this hate crime bill through the Dáil and the Seanad. And it's quite interesting where criticism of it is coming from and the debate over it, quite different parts of the political spectrum. Paul Murphy was of People Before Profit was very critical of it in the Dáil. Michael McDougall was asking questions about it in the Seanad. Are they justified?
Well, they're certainly justified in asking questions about it. That's their purpose, I guess, as legislators. There are very few issues, I think, you find that unify Matty McGrath and Paul Murphy. But on this one, they are ad idem. Now, the bill is, as you say, on its way through the Oireachtas. It has passed all stages in the Dáil. It now goes to the Seanad. It's the hate speech and hate crime law. In actual fact, what it does... Very briefly, is it rewrites the old incitement to hatred legislation and incorporates that, making prosecutions for incitement to hatred easier. But there must be incitement to hatred, incitement to violence in that. And it introduced the idea of a hate crime where an existing crime is made more serious by the application of hate or by the presence of hate towards somebody who has a protected characteristic. And that's important. So protected characteristic is race, colour, nationality, religion, national or ethnic origin, descent, gender, sex characteristic, sexual orientation, or disability. And it's the gender thing, I think, that is going to get some attention in the Seanad. And this is on the back of a letter written by Michael McDougall, Senator, former Attorney General, former Minister for Justice, who's written to Minister for Justice Simon Harris, asking for clarification of a couple of things before the bill gets to the floor of the Seanad, which I understand is due to happen in about 2 weeks or so. And he has pointed out something that I confess I didn't notice in looking at this in the Dáil stages, and of which there was very little debate. In fact, I could find just one reference to it in the various Dáil stages of the bill. And that is that it appears to expand the definition of gender. And so he compares it to the Gender Recognition Act, which establishes in law the right of a person to identify as either male or female. And if they do so, then they are recognised. If they wish to do so, then that can be recognised in law. And that's already established in law. But the definition of gender in the new bill, which will become the Hate Crime and Incitement to Hatred Act, if passed, the definition of gender in that is much broader. And it It says, it's best to read it out, I guess, from McDougall's letter. It says, gender means the gender of a person or the gender of a person or the gender which a person expresses as the person's preferred gender or with which the person identifies and includes transgender and a gender other than those of male or female. So the law, the proposed law then appears to expand, as I say, the definition of gender to include transgender and include other genders or genders other than male or female. And Michael McDougall has written to the Minister for Justice to say, could you please tell us what these are before we have the debate? And there it lies. As I don't think any reply is issued to Senator McDougall yet, but I do think that this aspect of the bill, which, as I say, was only focused on very briefly during the Dáil debates, when Simon Harris declined amendments from, amongst others, Éan Ó-Riordan, but in which he said, according to the transcript which I've read, that he is deliberately expanding that idea of gender. But I think that will be very much subject for debate. And Simon Harris, I think, will, if it is he who does the who does that legislative debate, will have to expand on what he means by that.
So there's a couple of things I should say about that, Jack. One is that we did a podcast a few months ago with Professor Owen O'Dell of Trinity College, where we went through some of those issues. So we can refer people back to that for some more detail on the legislation and his view on it. We should say also that Paul Murphy's objection was on a separate issue, which was a question of people holding material deemed to be hate speech and having to prove themselves that was not intended for dissemination. An important legal point. And we should also mention that unlike most legislation in the Oireachtas, this has come to the attention of no less than both Elon Musk and Donald Trump Jr. So there's a bang of culture wars off the whole thing, as there is with this subject of speech and the constraints on speech very often. But this specific one, it does seem strange to me, I don't know what you think, that an expansion of the definition of gender in law, which is something one can debate and one can pass or not pass, as the case may be, should occur in this particular instance rather than specifically in legislation specifically relating to gender. In other words, an amendment presumably to the legislation that was passed on gender a few years ago, because it's quite a change of the law and it's a strange way to do it.
I think that is the salient point, actually, Hugh, and I haven't covered the hate speech legislation as much as Pat, so I can't profess the same degree of familiarity with it, but I think that the key takeaway from this for me is that, you know, the kind of politics of culture wars or identity politics or whatever construction you like to put in it seems to be coming closer to the kind of centre of the political discourse in Ireland. And it seems to me that something that is not directly related to the gender issue, or maybe is adjacent to it in some ways, or kind of brushes past it, such as this piece of legislation, can all of a sudden become kind of turbocharged with all the baggage and all the kind of divisive forces that tend to characterise the debate around gender politics.
Yeah, like, you'll see no shortage of people. You'll find no problem finding people online who will claim that this is the end of Irish democracy if this legislation is passed, for example.
Exactly. And look, that's an interesting point as well, that a lot of this kind of bifurcation and the viciousness of the debate often is more visible online than it is in real life. But I think that, you know, that can be a bit of a comfort blanket sometimes as well, to pretend that this only plays out online, because of course it doesn't. It may be more visible online, it may be more vicious online, but it plays out in very real ways in the policymaking space and in both houses of the Oireachtas, as we can see. So, you know, it will be fascinating to see how Simon Harris, if he is still the Minister for Justice who confronts this, how he engages with it, whether he responds to Michael McDougall and the nature of his response, not only for the purposes of the hate speech legislation, but also whether it sets a kind of framework for, you know, how do you engage with these issues as and when they emerge in the policymaking space.
But it is still, just to reiterate, Pat, is it not a strange way to go about that in the context of this legislation rather than specifically in legislation that pertains to the subject of gender?
Yeah, I don't know what the rationale to it is. I mean, just looking at what Simon Harris said in the Dáil, the language is constantly evolving. The approach of taking in this bill attempts to future-proof this legislation to a degree by defining gender to include genders other than male or female. But because he is essentially adding these to those list of protected characteristics which have special protection in law, it seems to me that it requires a bit more definition than other, you know, than something which suggests that other genders or other definitions of gender may appear at some stage in the future, and they too will have protection of the law. So, yeah, it is you're right. It is a peculiar way to go about it. But I guess we'll see what happens when it comes to the Seanad, at which point we will be even more interested than we normally are in Seanad debates.
So, Jack, speaking of the Seanad, we were looking at what articles caught our interest this week, and you were looking at a piece by Ted Smith, who's a prominent figure in Irish-American circles, and he was writing about a subject which pops up a lot on the Irish Times letters page and sometimes on the Irish Times opinion pages, which is about votes for the Irish diaspora.
Yeah, so Ted Smith had an op-ed piece in on Tuesday, talking about Irish America and the importance of the relationship and all the rest of it. And then towards the end, it gets into this issue, which is one that, as you say, kind of pops up from time to time in the debate of how to accommodate or whether you should accommodate the diaspora within the parliament here. And it's something that I've always been extremely nervous about and kind of had a bit of an aversion to, just on the basic principle that, like, people living outside a jurisdiction, it seems odd to me that they would be giving a say effectively on the laws that...
Although lots of other countries do it.
Lots of other countries do it, but there's different ways of doing it, which I think where we should focus this debate. Just to finish the point that, you know, someone living outside the jurisdiction having an impact or a say on the laws that rule those who live within the jurisdiction seems strange to me. It seems to me to be, you know, also susceptible to the whims of you know, a polity that exists overseas and the political predilections for someone of someone who maybe hasn't lived in the jurisdiction for a long time or left the jurisdiction as a baby or something like that.
Or never lived here at all,
or never
because
lived
you
here
can
at
get
all.
Irish citizenship without
exactly
living.
Exactly that, you know, and you know, so for example, you know, like the constitutional question would be an interesting one, and the dissonance perhaps between the outlook of Irish America on the constitutional question and the outlook of people living in Ireland, which I would imagine is significantly more nuanced. But I think he's describing an idea whereby one of the panels in the Seanad might be given over to representation. I can't remember whether he said it would be specifically for Irish America or for Irish people overseas. And that is an idea that I think it goes some way towards a satisfactory to addressing this issue satisfactorily, because it stops short of giving you know Brooklyn a say in who gets elected in Dublin Bay North, but does go some way to accommodating the fact that the Irish diaspora is part of, you know, Ireland in the broadest sense. But it doesn't totally kind of defang it and also cheapen the presidency a little bit by saying, oh, let's give all the citizens overseas a vote in the presidential election, because sure, the subtext of that is it's just a free shot anyway. It's not really totally ceremonial office anyway, so it doesn't really matter. So I think it's an accommodation that I think other jurisdictions have done effectively. I remember during COVID, when we brought in the mandatory hotel quarantine, I was talking to some of the French parliamentarians whose constituency is French people living overseas, and they sit in the assembly, and you know, they don't have a seat, you know, in France, but they represent the interests of people living overseas, and they were advocating for French people living in Ireland whose travel rights had been curtailed in this instance. And I thought that was, you know, a very useful and real application of that structure, whereby they were actually advocating effectively both in France and in Ireland for a distinct group. And I think that, you know, thinking closely and cleverly about a solution to this It's something that we have to do, and I think that the Ted Smith piece gets us some way down that road. And you know, the idea of adapting the fairly antiquated kind of panel system in the Shannon to something more current, or an idea that has more purchase, such as allowing the diaspora an input, if not an outsized impact on Irish politics, I think is something.
It strikes me you could do a lot more with the Shannon than just do this.
We should have a podcast on Shannon reform.
Shannon are on the record. They're not particularly positive.
Just in case there's any
annual Shannon debate, but
we'll do a 3-part special on that. We know our listeners love that. Pat, just one point. I mean, the real politic of this is, it seems to me, is that there's always been a terror of the actual numbers here, because Ireland was a country which had a much larger emigrant population in the past. There's a hint in what Jack says that they might be a bit more green tinged in the way that they vote on constitutional issues. And then it raises the question of the many, many hundreds of thousands of Irish citizens who live north of the border.
There are the two things. There's citizens in the north, and there is the just the vast scale of the numbers abroad. And we give out Irish citizenship kind of almost anybody who wants it, you know. So obviously you've got difficulties there. But I'd save all my thoughts on that for our Shannon reform special.
Our seven part series. It's moved already up from 3 to 7. Pat, what have you been reading this week?
Yeah, the piece I picked was from yesterday's paper by Janan Ganesh, whose column we syndicate from the Financial Times, and he was talking about the end of the pandemic, and standing back from it, he was his case is actually that the West did pretty well in the pandemic, all told, and. It's an interesting piece. He says, if the future inquiries bear out the old Jean Kirkpatrick line, that we may have to face the truth about ourselves, no matter how pleasant it is. I'm not sure he's right about everything, but it's an interesting piece. And of course, we all look forward to the COVID inquiry whenever it happens. If only someone had written a book about it that we could use as a primer for the COVID inquiry.
Yeah, Jack, can you recommend anything?
I recommend Conor Gallagher's book. Buy my book.
One point to make on that actually is that I think when the COVID inquiry comes, that it shouldn't limit itself to government. I think we should also have maybe a look at the enthusiastic zero COVIDers. And their role in
No, I think I absolutely agree. I think we should look at absolutely everything.
I think there should be a module on the media, and I think that I should get 2 weeks off to prepare for my testimony. Pat, what do you think?
Well, for 2 weeks, we would expect really good jokes in your testimony.
Finally, speaking of the media, my article of the week is actually a live article. I like live articles. I like the way that they're sort of a pure play for the online part of what we do. They never appear in the newspaper, but they do something that regular newspaper articles don't do. Laura Slattery, who is a longtime lover of Eurovision, was doing the live article on the semi-final, which took place in Liverpool on Tuesday. Eurovision was obviously the biggest story of the week and continues to be. The final is tomorrow night, and we'll be watching it in my house anyway. Laura has a great turn of phrase. It's a really dry, witty piece. When you get a really good live article like that, you can read it back afterwards and still enjoy it, which I noticed that our readers were doing, because it was still ranking in our top 10 24 hours later. I'll be writing about Eurovision and the monarchy tomorrow, so there's my plug as well. We will leave it there anyway for today. Thanks very much indeed to Jack and to Pat. Thanks to our producer, Declan Conlon, our engineer, JJ Vernon. We're going to be back very soon after the weekend. Enjoy Eurovision. Talk to you then. The Irish Times Inside Politics podcast is taken to the road this year with a series of podcasts in front of live audiences. The first is on April the 10th in the Mac in Belfast, when we're going to be discussing the impact of the year of elections on politics across the island of Ireland. We would love to see you there and hear what you have to say too. So to book, go to events.irishtimes.com. That's events.irishtimes.com.